talk to the speaker's office.
I have another thing.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Wednesday, June 21st, 2017. Happy summer, everybody. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee of Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, and we are going to start with,
you're going to do in order, Linda?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to start by opening a work session on Senate Bill 512 relating to parentage. We heard about this bill last week.
You might want to warn people.
Okay.
That we're going to.
And just as a heads up, for those of you who are interested in 2834, we've had paperwork issues. We're going to be carrying over the public hearing and work session to tomorrow. So for those of you who care about that bill, now would be a good time to exit stage left unless you care about something else on the agenda, because you don't want to sit here the entire time. So that one's coming tomorrow. So 512.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 512 establishes parentage based on the presumption that the spouse of a birth mother is a parent to her child. This extends the current marital presumption to include same-sex spouses of birth mothers, providing a basis for parentage for purposes of child support. The bill also clarifies parentage related to children born as the result of assisted reproduction. And finally, the bill updates paternity parentage language to be gender neutral. You heard this bill in a public hearing on June 12th. The Dash A4 amendment simply adds the $52,000 fiscal that will fund the system work that needs to be done by the Oregon Health Authority.
Okay.
Right. Madam Chair, I move adoption of the Dash A4 amendment.
Co-Chair Rayfield moves to adoption of the Dash A4 amendment to Senate Bill 512. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so moved.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 512 be submitted to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves Senate Bill 512 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation as amended. Is there a discussion? Is there opposition? If not, so moved. Who's on this bill?
It's a committee bill, judiciary. It was a DOJ bill.
Oh, okay. I'll take this to full and to the Senate floor. And I think Representative Nose has been working on this one, so we could let him take it in the House.
Okay.
So, thank you. Okay, I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill 512. Opening a work session on Senate Bill 397 related to the sharing of information between social services providers, a bill I know well.
Madam Chair, as you know, Senate Bill 397 was heard before this committee for a public hearing on June 6th. It requires the Department of Human Services to convene and provide support to the work group to create standard client confidentiality release forms and to be used by entities that provide social services, including healthcare, mental health services, substance abuse, treatment services, education services, juveniles, justice services, adult correction services, employment services, and human services. It also requires DOJ to review applicable laws to help in this effort. And the bill is anticipated to have minimal fiscal impact to OHA, DHS, and DOJ, as well as the Department of Education and the Oregon Youth Authority. And there is no amendment. It's ready to go as is.
Thank you.
All right. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 397 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Co-Chair Rayfield moves Senate Bill 397 with a due pass recommendation of the full committee. Is there discussion?
Just a comment.
Yes, ma'am.
It's long, 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 long overdue.
Thank you, ma'am. Yes, it is. And I'm very, very excited about this bill.
And it's my hope that we don't get further procrastination in getting this form done. This discussion has gone on in this building as long as this chronologically advantaged person has been here.
Okay, good. If not, so moved. And since it's my bill, I will take it to full into the Senate. And Representative Malmstrom, you want to take this on the House floor? Thank you. Okay. Close the work session on 397. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2170. Ms. Tome.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2170 establishes the new Office of the Oregon Ombudsman to house the following five independent programs: the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, which currently exists within the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, the Residential Facilities Ombudsman, which also currently is within the Long-Term Care Office, the Oregon Public Guardian, which is currently within the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office, and the foster, and then it creates two new, it transferred the Foster Child Ombudsman from DHS into this new agency and creates a new ombudsman, the Foster Parent Ombudsman. And there should be some, we're expecting some amendments. We don't have them yet. And
okay. And Representative Stark, this is your bill, so if you'd like to come up, and Mr. Steele and Ms. Cowan, you guys can all come up in one fell swoop if you'd like, since there's only three of you on the list. Representative Stark, educate us, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Senator Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. I won't spend much time on the policy conversation about this. We'll jump into the fiscal part in just a moment. But overall, when we started out with this bill, the goal were twofold. We wanted to create a foster parent ombudsman. If you have paid attention to what's gone on in town halls and foster parents and the number of foster parents we've been losing throughout the state, you'd see that they are concerned. And foster parents, by and large, have said, we want a voice. We want to be able to have someone that we call that we can have advocate on our behalf, hence the foster parent ombudsman. The other thing that we wanted, second goal, was to take the foster child ombudsman out from under the Department of Human Services so they have a little bit more freedom to do their job as an ombudsman. To me and many others, it felt odd that the foster child ombudsman may investigate DHS but then report back to DHS. So the goal is to pull them out. And although it says it's a governor-appointed position, the idea would be that the current foster child ombudsman would remain the foster child ombudsman in this new situation. But the more challenging question was, how do we do this? And so Fred Steele in the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's office has worked really hard to figure out some good ways of doing this, how we can rename the organization and silo it. And I actually meant to pass these out to you. This is on color-coded chart that he put together that is under the bill materials, but not for today, just under the bill itself materials that he can talk through at some point if you want to know the actual structure of how to divide this out so that the different groups aren't invading each other's space in a sense. The foster parent, foster child ombudsman wouldn't be communicating. There would actually be a bit of a wall put in and a structure put in place so that they are not sharing information that they shouldn't be sharing. So, but to the amendment, and then I'll let Mr. Steele speak to any sort of fiscal that we expect. Amendments, we actually thought that the bill was not moving forward, and so the very final, just that sort of climate, so the final amendments we had not put together yet. So DOJ had some small technical things. I have those in my hand. Long-Term Care Ombudsman Office, they had some small things, pretty substantive, I can't speak this morning, but probably the biggest one to me is actually changing the name change that we wanted to make. We wanted to change the name to Oregon Office of Ombudsman, but me being a Duck alumni, I was a big fan of Triple O. This is Co-Chair Rayfield. However, Mr. Steele advised me to be wiser than that.
Taste.
And
poor
said
taste.
and pointed out that the office, if you take a look at all the groups that are in there, that the Office of Oregon Ombudsman would not be the best name. So one of the amendments is actually changing the name to Office of Ombudsman and Advocacy Services, which is a little more all-inclusive for the different groups that are in there. On that note, though, I'll turn it over to Mr. Steele to talk about what we expect as far as the positions that would be created and the transferring of positions and any sort of fiscal that we expect, and then we'll turn it over to Stacey.
Thank you. Mr. Steele.
Yeah, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. So my name is Fred Steele, the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, Director of the current Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and definitely want to be able to answer any questions that you have around the proposed structure under House Bill 2170, what that means for our current programs, as well as foster parent, foster child ombudsman coming over. I will make one additional point that one of the structures, at least before getting to the fiscal, but one of the structures with this House Bill 2170 is it actually addresses a current conflict of law that we have with federal law. with the Public Guardian Program being under the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, under the Federal Older Americans Act, and particularly in language that was incorporated just last year when it was reauthorized, it emphasized further that the Long-Term Care Ombudsman cannot be supervising the Public Guardian in a Public Guardian program. So House Bill 2170 will alleviate that federal law conflict that currently exists. Not that the feds are expecting us to get that fixed in a single year, but it would address that now. And they would have expected a change at some point in the next 3, 4, 5 years. As far as the fiscal and what we're proposing, obviously the foster parent ombudsman position would be new. We're also proposing an administrative specialist to assist, and it would be almost half time for each program, but a single administrative specialist to assist with foster child ombudsman, foster parent ombudsman. We're still working on the fiscal around IT support in particular. Right now, our office with our three programs, we have a contractor that we have utilized long before I arrived at the office. We had changed over to becoming a Mac shop, so using Macintosh and Apple computers, which DAS doesn't support, so we haven't been using DAS support, I think, ever, definitely in my year and a half at the office. But we're still working out. My understanding is there's some changes in that direction at DAS, and just even this week and these last couple of days, trying to identify how best to address the IT supports by adding two new programs and some additional staff. Whether we'll still go forward with the contractor, or as we put forward in our first draft fiscal here in the last couple of days, is possibly what's called an ISS6. I don't know what ISS stands for, but that would basically be an
Information Services Specialist.
Thank you. So, possibly that position, and then trying to figure out whether there's potentially two staff or one staff that would support the administrator level of this new agency. So again, as Representative Stark mentioned, that in the bill file in OLIS, there is kind of a very rough, colorful chart, as he kind of showed you here, that's in OLIS that kind of shows what the structure of the office looks like. And this administrator that's not going to be a director of the office, all of the policy will stay within each of those five programs, but there is still that higher level administrative operational supports that will be needed. So. If I can answer any questions that you may have.
As you know, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. You and I have had extensive conversation about this particular issue, particularly whether or not we're just kind of creating an entity or whether, honestly, that we're talking about creating an office that truly is an ombudsman for foster parents and children with investigative powers, if you will, that with it, you know, as you know, you and I have talked, the ombudsman is only as effective as the powers that it has granted. And those powers include the ability to investigate, to resolve, as well as to actually look at trends so that you can actually make those recommendations to the legislature as well as the governor's office. And I've got some real concern with this kind of structure as to whether or not we're actually just saying that that exists, but not having those kinds of powers and giving the impression that one may be able to do that when they cannot. It includes everything from whether or not how you can get into the agency to get information from that agency. So I still have those concerns. My other one is that an ombudsman should be a change agent. And so my question on change agency is, what happens with the Foster Parents Association and what is their role and function with this? And those are the questions that I still have with respect to this particular proposal. I love the concept of creating one big office, but with it needs to come the powers that in order to allow it to function.
Yeah. Co-Chair, Senator Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Senator Winters, first of all, it just occurred to me that you may not know who I am since I forgot to introduce myself.
I didn't even notice because I'm so used to having you with this committee. I miss you this year, but I've been used to having you.
State Representative,
here.
House District 4 in Southern
you.
Oregon. One of the things I do want to, there are significant conversations with the Department of Human Services.
So,
and
what is your name?
Dwayne Stark. I did just say.
I said.
Some people mistake me for Dan Rayfield or Dallas Hurd.
Oh, Yeah, never. Yeah. Never, so, ever, ever, for reasons I won't go into.
Yes, I do want to say that, you know, Department of Justice and DHS had very extensive conversations to make sure that the foster parent and foster child ombudsman would have appropriate access to the records that the foster child ombudsman currently has. So there was significant work put into that. In fact, the majority of the last amendment, you know, dealt with that to make sure, and that's to one of your questions.
And Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, Senator Winters, to that investigative authority in particular, the autonomy of these programs to be able to function, and I'll root it in what I know best, which is the long-term care ombudsman role, and the expectations of that role to be independent and an investigatory change agent to really utilize the independence of that position and the program to compel change and preserve the rights of residents and long-term care facilities, going against the flow if need be, whether it even be political flow, to make sure that the rights of residents are upheld, that their dignity and their independence are preserved through the powers of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program. The introduced bill of House Bill 2170 initially created a single structure of a director that looked like any other state agency, but on paper that would take away some of that independence of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and I think in function it absolutely would have. It would have created a potential controlling mechanism from other powers to control that director, and then the director have to control the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. With the structure that's in this engrossed bill, and it's being just tweaked a little bit by further amendment, it preserves the independence. It preserves the power and the authorities of not only the long-term care ombudsman, but then also in the residential facility ombudsman with power that it's had, and also as passed through Senate Bill 58 this current session as well, to further clarify the powers of the residential facility ombudsman, even with the public guardian program, with foster child ombudsman transferring from DHS. I think it's going to definitely maximize that independence and investigatory authority for that position. And for the foster parent ombudsman and the connection with the association, that one is a little harder for me to speak to. And it may be that during the implementation, I think that the plan at this point is for implementation of July 2018, which will give us time to work out any potential kinks. And I would contend to possibly come back next February if we have to address, you know, some concerns such as that.
Representative Alonso Leon.
Thank you, Chair, Co-Chair. I definitely appreciate the concept of centralizing offices. I think that's really important, particularly because you have an opportunity to learn from each other. Yeah, you have an opportunity to really take some issues and be able to identify how you can fix things, right? Separate from the agency, which I think is very important. So I completely support this bill on the bill itself also, but for those reasons, because I think it's the right thing to do.
I'll make a brief side comment about before I get to Ms. Cowan. I promise we will. As a longtime Mac person, I wish to heck the state would support Macs as well, because a lot of us get frustrated enough that we just bring our own computers as witness. The many of us on this desk who are using Mac platforms if we could. Anyway, that's a little aside to our friends in DAS and Legislative Information System, who otherwise I adore. Ms. Cowan.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Stacey Cowan. I'm with SEIU. SEIU represents nearly 65,000 workers throughout the state, including the frontline workers at DHS Child Welfare, and I'm here in support of House Bill 2170. I've had the opportunity to come before you and talk about the significant understaffing at DHS, including problems with recruitment and retention. We're having a hard time attracting workers to the job, and then we're having a hard time keeping folks in those jobs. Similarly, we've seen over the years a problem growing with recruitment and retention of high-quality, diverse placement settings for foster children. We think that the impact of staffing really can be felt throughout the system, and that includes the support or the lack of support that foster parents are feeling. We actually really believe that the staffing is truly kind of at the the heart of a number of the issues that foster parents face. One of the biggest ones that we hear from our workers through the foster parents really is around communication. We have to address the staffing issue, but we really believe that legislation like House Bill 2170 is a really important key piece of the puzzle. Foster parents have to have an independent voice. We believe that that really is paramount to making sure that we have the accountability that we need. We also believe that if we're really going to get at the heart of recruitment and retention for, again, high-quality foster care placements, we really should be doing more, including things like offering free or subsidized child care for foster parents. We've heard things around around maybe respite care and those kinds of policies. So, again, not quite the purview of this legislation, but we really believe that there's more that we can and should be doing. And then lastly, I would just say as far as the foster youth piece, we absolutely support any legislation that empowers foster youth in the system. And again, we really wholeheartedly believe in the importance of having an opportunity for foster youth to have an independent voice in the system. So with that, I'll close my remarks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any further questions? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2170 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 419. Welcome back, Ms. Ames. We should have done this in a different order so you and Ms. Tow didn't have to bounce back and forth so much. Thank you.
I didn't expect to be this question.
For clarification.
Yeah.
After this year.
Hey, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Cedric wants to make a brief statement on the bill we're carrying over.
Absolutely. Let's get through 419 first, and I'd be happy to have you do that, Representative Hayden.
Thank you.
Senator Meyer's office said he was coming, but I don't see him. Is this Senator or Representative Nose with that?
Representative Nose, are you on 419 also? Okay. How about if we hang for just a second and I let you can do that, but then Representative Hayden, even though we're in the works in the public hearing for 419, why don't you go ahead and do that now, and hopefully Senator Meyer's on his way down.
Okay. All right. Thank you, co-chairs. So just a brief statement on House Bill 2834, and I can present it in more detail tomorrow, but I think it's helpful to clarify some things. This bill has been effectively in the works that I've been involved with and probably before that for 3 years. So this is not just a last-minute one-time bill. It does appear to have the opportunity to be moving forward and with the relating to clause of health care. As you can imagine, my office has become Grand Central over the last couple of weeks. I have said the same thing to all requesters. Please find a different vehicle for whatever amendment or policy that you're trying to get through, because this bill is important for seniors and veterans that have not had adequate oral health care coverage for many years. And so I can get more detailed about that. But I just want to get on the record. I am not amending this bill, and I'm requesting that it doesn't get amended.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Well, Ms. we don't see Senator Beyer here yet. So why don't you go ahead and explain the bill to us, Ms. Ames, and then Representative Nose can come up. And
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, Senate Bill 419 establishes the Task Force on Healthcare Cost Review. It requires the task force to study the feasibility of establishing a hospital rate-setting process in Oregon, and in particular looking at the Maryland model, where they have done this for a long time.
Okay. Representative Nose, come on up.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, for the record, my name's Rob Nose. I'm the state representative for House District 42, and I've had the pleasure of working with Senator Beyer on this kind of concept. There was a House version of this bill. We tried it 2 years ago. Aside from prescription drug costs, the other big cost driver in the healthcare system, broadly defined, is the cost of hospitals and a hospital stay or services in a hospital. And Maryland has probably the most sort of comprehensive approach to treating healthcare kind of like a utility, sort of gathering up all the buckets of money that are involved in paying for healthcare services, Medicare, Medicaid, and then commercial insurance, and then trying to figure out how to set a price for services based on the procedure and a little bit where the hospital is located vis-a-vis, is it in a rural area? And so, you know, you have to have an ER going, so maybe you charge a little more in those facilities so that you can stand up an emergency room on an ongoing basis. I won't pretend to admit that this is not a super big change, and that's why you have an actual study bill or task force before you as opposed to outright implementation. This would be, you know, I think last night in preparation for this, last year the hospital economy, just the straight up hospital finances, was almost $12 billion in revenue that was generated in the hospital system in terms of their operations and their finances, with an average profit margin of 7%. They don't like to use profit because most of them are nonprofits, with the exception of two hospitals. And so this is my point in pointing that out is that this is a big part of our economy, changing how we finance and stand up hospitals to look at something like Maryland is doing, probably absolutely deserves study. The OHA and the governor would need to come back to us and say, this is something we want to do, and here's how we would stand it up. And so having a study is probably a good first step.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Noes? Excellent. Thank you, Representative Noes. I am very intrigued by this prospect
as
well.
Too.
I think it'll be very interesting to figure out whether it's workable here in Oregon.
And having a study will help us do that.
Yep. Excellent. Okay. We have three other witnesses, Kevin Campbell, Paul Cosgrove, and Jared Mason Gear. Come on up, gentlemen, although I think you're all in favor of this. How nice. I'm a little stunned.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, of members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and yes, speak in favor of Senate Bill 419. I want to begin by thanking Senator Beyer, who worked with us and other stakeholders to create this task force and this opportunity to thoughtfully and fully evaluate rate setting models and their appropriateness for Oregon. I want you to know that we're really fully committed to engage in this process, lending our expertise, our time, and our efforts to play a positive role in this conversation. A few quick items. Obviously, this allows us to study the feasibility of creating a hospital rate setting process modeled on the Healthcare Services Cost Review Commission in Maryland. Maryland's often pointed to as the model of hospital rate setting, and it's been in place since 1977. It is important to note, and I think some of you realize, that Maryland needed some special federal approvals in order to experience the success they've had, so we'd have to look at how this might work in Oregon, knowing that. But I think this bill will help Oregon learn from Maryland and review how a rate-setting system may impact healthcare access, quality, and cost containment. I think it's a very valuable conversation. An important element of 419 is it requires a task force to review how rate setting would interact with all the pieces of the healthcare system, including CCOs, PEP and OEB, and commercial payers altogether. This comprehensive and systematic all-payer approach will help ensure that we avoid unintended consequences and kind of a piecemeal approach that could negatively impact the healthcare services and programs that Oregonians depend on. As a cautionary tale, we know that implementing Maryland's system without consideration for what would work best in Oregon is not recommended. Washington State did implement the Maryland model word for word, and they spent 10 years of implementing it, and it failed. So we do know that you have to approach this in a way that understands the state's unique needs, challenges, and opportunities. We believe that 419 gives policy leaders and stakeholders an opportunity to review key policy goals, develop key core principles for rate setting development, and to identify challenges and opportunities, as I've mentioned already, unique to Oregon. And so with that, we're fully committed to participate in this process. And again, we appreciate the committee's time and consideration of Senate Bill 419A. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Cosgrove.
Thank you, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing Legacy Health, also in support of Senate Bill 419 in the version before you today. I'm going to make two quick points, and to set them up, I'd like to just remind something this committee well knows so well, which is this has been a difficult year for healthcare funding, in particular healthcare. Oregon Health Plan in Oregon. And hospitals, along with others in the healthcare community, have stepped up with a package that you have approved, and we hope it's well on its way to final approval here. But that's been at a significant cost, real dollar cost. Systems like Legacy and others are still tallying up the costs of those, but I can tell you they're in tens of millions of dollars. Although Representative Nose is correct about the 2015 kind of margins that hospitals had, the system I represent, that started to drop pretty significantly in 2016, and it's continued to drop in 2017. So 2015 may have been an outlying but very good year. That isn't a guarantee of future. In addition, some of us, starting even yesterday, I know we're not done with the 17-19 budget, but we're starting to talk about 19-21. And we believe, based on initial data, our choices that you will face and we will face in 19-21 are likely to be even more difficult. And we're starting that work now. So that's the setup for my two points. One is just to reemphasize something Mr. Campbell said, which is I hope we're laser-focused on not Maryland as a exact model, but Maryland as an illustrative example of what we might do here, because there are significant differences. We all know of those differences in our healthcare market. We've done things very differently here for years, and we need to make sure that whatever system that we look at takes into account those differences. That's something Mr. Campbell said. I just want to reemphasize it. And then secondly, there, by my back of the envelope calculations, the market here on the commercial side is roughly about 1.8 million people, Medicare about a quarter of the population, Medicaid about a quarter of the population in terms of lives in Oregon. So it's important that we have all of those people in the discussion, as Mr. Campbell said. But there will be things that are elsewhere in this building in a different subcommittee that will make that very, very difficult if we jump ahead and start to set rates for a significant chunk of that by legislative action before this is done. And so I just bring to your attention that under Senate Bill 1067, we would be setting the rates for about just shy of 20% of all Oregon lives would be set in that bill. And it would make the discussion about 419 and an overall process very much more difficult. We need to make sure that we look at all the lives as we're looking at this system. So I just bring that as a cautionary tale. Thank you. Happy to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cavett. We'll hear from Mr. Mason Gear first, and then we'll take questions. If that's okay. We'd like to hear from all three of them, and then we'll go. Mr. Mason Gear.
Morning, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. Jared Mason Gear here on behalf of the Oregon Education Association, representing 44,000 professional educators across the state. Also in support of SB 419A. As Representative Nose referenced, we know that hospital costs are a significant driver in healthcare costs. We're seeing record cash reserves, record executive compensation in the hospital sphere. Why does the Oregon Education Association care? Why do Oregon educators care? We're seeing significant impacts of these facts on the families of the students that our members serve, and then on the Oregon Educator Benefit Board itself as well. As we've seen double-digit premium increases, those costs impact school districts and impacts our members. And we've looked carefully at the Maryland model. As has been referenced, it may not be an exact fit here, but we do believe it holds a lot of promise. Also, a lot of questions, I think, still about how this would interface with federal rules and changing landscape with federal health care policy. So that's why we believe that this version of the bill is the appropriate step forward, that taking a careful study, an examination of how to move this forward, looking at how we can make this work in Oregon, and coming back to the legislature with some recommendations on how we can move forward. So we urge your support, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Jason, I'm glad to hear you support price controls. Would you be willing to accept similar price controls on the health care benefits of OEA members in the state of Oregon?
Co-chairs, Representative Bueller, I think there's we would need to know more about what that would look like. I mean, certainly there's a number of proposals out there. When you're looking at, for example, educators that are making sacrifices in salary, when you look at what someone in the private sector makes with a master's degree compared to what someone in the education field makes with a master's degree, the exchanges that they've made, you know, average starting salary for an educator in Oregon, $35,000 a year, those trade-offs in exchange for secure retirement, in exchange for stable and decent health care benefits for themselves and their families. Those are conversations that have been had at the local level in the collective bargaining process. We're really hesitant to do things that would interfere with that collective bargaining process, but are there going to be changes? Are there going to have to be sacrifices that are made over the course of the coming years to ensure that we can continue to fund schools at an adequate level, which we aren't doing currently? We're very aware that those are conversations that are going to have to occur. Yes.
Mr. Cosgrove, I'm interested if you think the state of Oregon could, like the state of Maryland, acquire a over $1.5 billion supplement from the federal government to make an Oregon equivalent Maryland model work. Because that's a key component of why it works in Maryland, is that there is a waiver from the federal government of over $1.5 billion. So do you think that would be forthcoming for Oregon also?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Representative Bueller, that's a very good question. I mean, we have been very successful in the past at getting big pots of federal money. I think it's a different game in Washington. I think we all know that now. I think that's highly debatable whether that could possibly occur. And obviously, without that, the Maryland model may not work, and there may not be any model that works. So I think that's one of the questions we need to ask. Is that feasible? Is that practical? Is that likely to happen? And if it doesn't happen, is the whole system going to work? So I think it's an excellent question, one we just don't know the answer to. I think there's some skepticism that we can get that kind of money out of Washington like we did a couple of years ago.
Thank you, Co-Chair. So just wanted to speak to the need of some future planning, and I know that there's many people supportive. You mentioned, Mr. Cosgrove, supportive of our health care funding package for Medicaid going forward, but I do have some concerns with that, and the concerns going forward in the future are match rate, assuming they don't change anything, will decrease on the expanded population. We have set into the current plan that's moving forward, which hasn't passed yet, sunsets in there, which will, in effect, once the fiscal budgeting comes out for 1921, will result in a multi-billion-dollar shortfall in Medicaid because of the way the system, the financial system, is set up with taxes and sunsets. So we know today that shortfall for the 1921 budget will be multi-billion-dollar shortfalls. So I'm not so excited about setting up a process in 2 years that we have maybe double the shortfall that we have today. So will this task force help that?
Co-Chair Senator Hayward, Representative Hayden, I don't know that it will. I don't think it's harmful by any means to start looking at alternatives. I agree, my client agrees very much with your statement that what we look at in 1921 is likely to, what we did this year may pale in significance to what we're likely to have to face in 1921.
I would absolutely agree with that.
It's predictable. The match rate will drop. There'll be cost drivers that will increase. We can guess what those are, and that's without any significant changes at the federal level in the Medicaid program, which we all know is at least a possibility, if not a probability. So will this change that landscape? I don't think it will, but it will be worth, I think, we believe, looking at this, and we're committed to helping people in a broad group of all the interested parties looking at this to see if it is part of the answer, controlling costs. Willing to look at it. That doesn't mean it will solve the problem, and it will not come up with multi-billion dollars worth of savings that are the kind of thing you're predicting.
Follow up.
Yes.
Thank you. So Why is there such a strong consensus in the healthcare industry for this year's budgeting of Medicaid when we know today that there's going to be a multi-billion dollar shortfall without some plan done today that would start to addressing next biennium? Why is there such a strong consensus of such a short-term plan with that outcome?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Hayden, I think the Hospital Association statement on that plan was reluctantly agreed to it. And I think that's probably a good summary of where most of the members who are supporting that plan are. I think there was a feeling that without a short-term plan, lots of bad things would happen relatively soon. Was it considered to be the long-term solution? I'm not sure anybody thought it would be the long-term solution for just the reasons you mentioned.
So I'm not hearing buyer's remorse before this even passes, right?
No.
Okay.
No, you're not. But I don't think it solves all the problems for the future.
Thank you.
I mean, you're right in that sense. It does not solve all the problems for the future. It solves the problems for this biennium.
Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. To follow up along Representative Hayden's line of questioning, certainly cost control is certainly needed with regards to what the state of Oregon's paying for PEB and OEB. It's clearly outpacing what the state can afford. But I'm puzzled why we would just restrict our attention on the Maryland model, where it hasn't been very successful. It's been supplemented by a large amount of federal dollars. And actually, the results are poor. Spending on hospital spending has been faster than the national average in Maryland. So why are we looking at this model as opposed to more fundamental reforms like system delivery reform, you know, to take the cost drivers out of the equation, you know, switching to a value-based reimbursement model instead of volume like we've done in the Medicaid market?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Buehler, I don't think we think this is in exclusion of any of those, and those things ought to happen as well. With respect to a question you asked earlier, I think there are other cost containment issues that are yet to be brought forward. I was in a meeting yesterday where kind of cost containment issues regarding public employee healthcare costs was one of the topics, and I think some of those will be rolled out even late in this session. So this isn't by any means, we believe, the sole method or even maybe even the primary method of moving forward. We just think it's worthwhile spending some time studying it.
I would point out to members of the committee that if the text of the bill, while it references the Maryland system, also includes a broader mandate to the task force to consider other models and other aspects of cost setting and how it would interact with PEB and OEB and the CCOs and things like that. I just took a look to confirm that. That was what I thought I remembered. But it references the Maryland model a lot, but it also talks about looking at other options as well for cost containment and hospital rate setting.
And that's an important aspect of that we agree with. Thank you.
Okay, your question?
I do, just a brief comment, and I think we've all been sitting in numerous committees, and I think I just want to comment on kind of a disturbing trend that we've been seeing is that because I'm sick and tired of seeing the trio of Campbell Cosgrove and Jared Mason Gear, you know, coming in here and pushing their forward-thinking legislation. It is a successful.
Yeah.
I don't know where to end. So somehow,
it's
as a committee, we need
yeah.
to break this group up.
Madam Co-Chair, if I may, we'll try to avoid that in the future.
All right. Any further questions for this panel? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 419. As previously mentioned, we've carried over 2834 to tomorrow. We will be meeting tomorrow with at least that on the agenda.
One more.
And one other bill on the agenda tomorrow. So we'll see you all here tomorrow at 8:30. Ms. Ames, anything else for the good of the order? Colleagues, anything else? We're adjourned.